Hello and welcome to the Ricardian podcast, the podcast where we shine a light on the life and times of Richard III of England, and which is brought to you by the Richard III Society. In this episode, we're taking a deep dive into the life of Maximilian I, Holy Roman Emperor from 1508 to 1519, and an individual who in his day would have counted amongst the most powerful men in Europe, if not the world. Throughout his long career, Maximilian sought to burnish the standing and power of the House of Habsburg, never less so than during his time as co-ruler of the Burgundian Netherlands in the late 1470s and 1480s, which is where he intersects most directly with the fortunes of the House of York and the story of Richard III. Max also impinges on the story of late medieval England through two claimants or pretenders to the English throne known to history as Lambert Simnel and Perkin Warbeck. Importantly, this is a narrative which has been further embellished by recent historical documentary discoveries, findings which arguably make Max a figure of even greater interest on these shores than ever before. Joining us to discover Kaiser Max, as he was also known, is the author, historian, history hit presenter, and former chair of the Richard III Society, Matt Lewis. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you very much, Alec. Great to be here.
We're also joined by Wendy Moorhen, a former research officer of the Richard III Society, who has also been published in the Ricardian, that's the Society's academic journal, as well as in the members' magazine, the Ricardian Bulletin, for which she has contributed the cover story about Max for this latest edition. Welcome, Wendy.
Hi.
Let us begin then. So, Wendy, could you please begin by introducing us to Max and giving us some further appreciation of how he's connected to the House of York and indeed Richard III?
Right, well, you've already said Max was born 1459, it was in Austria. His father was Frederick III, the Holy Roman Emperor, and of course that is an elected position. His mother was the Infanta Eleanor of Portugal, and she died when he was eight, but I think they were very close, and she certainly gave him a love of romanticism. He's quite a controversial character. Historians can't quite agree on him. The 19th century German historians were fairly critical. But in the 20th century, they have been much kinder, apparently. And I use the word apparently because we have limited access to Maximilian's history, because unless you're proficient in German, all the really good stuff, I'm afraid, is only available in German. Though there are quite a few in English, but the five-volume work on him by a guy called Hermann Weisflecker, sadly, is just not available to us. He was a brave man. He was a soldier, not always successful, but he was brave, and he was a workaholic. And once he was emperor, he was peripatetic. He was roaming all over Austria, Germany, the Low Countries. And of course, he went into Switzerland for a war and into Italy for the same reason. He's a man, he played hard and he worked hard. He loved hunting, that was his recreation. And he was rather fond of the ladies. He was also probably one of the world's greatest self-publicists and propagandists, certainly of his age. He wrote three biographical books, and he really believed in his own self-aggrandizement. And he used printing, the new technology of printing, and the medium of art to express this. He said in his own words, just to confirm this, he said, "If you do not set yourself a monument during your lifetime, you'll have none after your death, and be forgotten with the tolling of the last bell." And we've not forgotten him. Connections to House of York, mainly through his marriage to Mary of Burgundy. Her stepmother was Margaret of York, the sister to Edward IV. When Charles Bold, the Duke of Burgundy, was killed in 1477, he was already affianced to Duchess Mary, the heir. And Margaret really facilitated the marriage very quickly, because once the Duke was dead, Louis XI marched into the Low Countries, hoping to grab it. He's using the Salic Law as the excuse. So the marriage was brought forward. They married within about 6 months of Charles's death. And Margaret was very influential in the duchy, and she and Maximilian got on quite well. She returned to England in 1480, to try and get her brother to repudiate his treaty with France. She was unsuccessful, but she did manage to recruit a few archers for her adopted country. Maximilian liaised with Richard III. Again, Richard supplied archers for the problems Maximilian had in Utrecht. And the further dimension is not to the House of York, but the House of Lancaster. When Henry VI died, Duke Charles notarised his claim to the throne of England. And that was through his mother, Isabel of Portugal, the daughter of Philippa of Lancaster. And of course, Maximilian himself, because his mother was Portuguese, was also a descendant of John of Gaunt.
Fantastic, right. And am I right in thinking that Max is the sort of man who believes sort of firmly in sort of courtly or knightly culture, you know, leads his troops into battle on horseback?
Very much. His first battle was at Gwynedd in 1478, and the pikemen, the infantry, were on the ground fighting the French, basically, I think, losing at that stage. Maximilian got off his horse and asked all his followers to get off their horses and to join him, and he went into the melee in hand-to-hand combat.
Right, okay, so he's got a lot of physical courage himself, as well as a great propagandist and everything else. Okay, in that case, let's bring in the bigger picture. Matt, before we delve into the princes in the tower and other connections to House of York, could you offer us a kind of snapshot of the geopolitics of Europe at the time we're talking about, the 1470s, 1480s, 1490s, as well as Max, who are the main players and powers and what were they trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you've got France, the perhaps in many ways the biggest player on the Western European field at this time. You've got Louis XI is king there for his reign almost matches exactly the reign of Edward IV in England. He becomes king a few months after, and he dies a few months after Edward dies too. So from 1483, you've got Charles VIII there in France, Louis's son, who comes to the throne at the age of 13. So we see France then sort of wrapped up in a bit of a minority crisis. They enter a period of civil conflict known as the Mad War from 1485 to 1488, which is an argument over the regency of the still young Charles VIII. So France is facing, you know, a few troubles of its own in the late sort of 1480s. Ferdinand and Isabella are on the scene in Spain, so the Iberian Peninsula, you know, we're starting to talk a bit more about Spain and Portugal, what had previously been a whole raft of kingdoms on the Iberian Peninsula. You've got the famous Ferdinand and Isabella, the Catholic monarchs there, completing the Reconquista, taking all of the land back from the Muslims that from North Africa that had held parts of the Iberian Peninsula for centuries by this point. And they are the people who Henry VII is going to be courting. They're the parents of Catherine of Aragon, who he's very keen in getting into England in a marriage alliance later in the 1490s. And then sort of satellites of France, you've got Burgundy, who we're obviously talking about with Mary and Maximilian and Margaret of York there. But you've also got on the other side, you've got Brittany, which is also trying to assert its own independence from France and stay outside the complete control of the Crown of France. You've got Francis, Duke of Brittany there, who dies in 1488 and is succeeded by his daughter, Anne, who will become an important figure on the marriage market because of her ability to offer some control of Brittany. And then you've also got the Dukes of Milan, the Doges of Venice in Italy, people like that being very important players on the scene too. And I think one of the things that we need to be aware sort of dominates European politics for much of this period in the 1480s and 1490s in particular is the Holy League. So this is an effort to prevent French incursions into Italy. So a desire to get all of the other Christian countries together to fend off France's interest in pressing further and further into Italy. Now, most of those in the Holy League, which includes Italian princes, Spain, they're really keen to get Henry VII of England into the Holy League. But there is a stumbling block because Maximilian is in there, and Henry sort of makes his membership conditional on Maximilian dropping his support for, in particular in the 1490s, Perkin Warbeck, Richard of England, the man claiming to be the younger of the princes in the tower. So it becomes a kind of stumbling block and arguing point for membership of the Holy League in the 1490s.
So to put it in a nutshell, it sounds like Europe is kind of a bag of snakes all fighting each other. You've got France is big and powerful, trying to gobble up some small countries, small princedoms or duchies around it. Germany is largely under control of the Habsburgs. And you've got Spain, which is, you know, emerging, coming together, and it's becoming the power that it will become.
and England is sort of having its own battles and trying to work out who's in charge, and everyone's trying to basically gang up together to come out on top in the usual fashion for Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's very much a sense by the 1490s, I think, that it's everyone against France. Everyone is trying to get together to fight the French.
Absolutely. They really are the bad guys.
Which essentially is a kind of European tradition for the next 400 years until, 1815. Okay. All right, so that's the big picture. Thank you very much, both of you. Let's talk about Max and people known at large as the princes in the Tower, so the sons of Edward IV, Edward V, that is, and Richard, Duke of York, people who are known to history as Lambert Simnel and Perkin Warbeck. Matt, could you give us an overview of what kind of happened to them, which is a big story, but in a nutshell, and how what the evidence is that Max was helping them achieve their objectives?
I can't believe you're cruel enough to ask me to do this quickly, but yeah, I can try. Essentially, you get, obviously, the two main pretenders who will claim the throne of Henry VII. The first is in 1487, and this is remembered by history as the Lambert Simnel affair, so generally thought to have been an uprising in favour of Edward, Earl of Warwick, who is another nephew of Edward IV and Richard III, spearheaded by someone who is claimed to be an imposter, a boy named Lambert Simnel from Oxford. They invade England, there is a battle at Stoke, and they are defeated. And we're told that this boy, Lambert Simnel, is captured, shown mercy by Henry VII, and put to work in the kitchens. I'm not sure that's the whole story. The other school of thought is that this uprising was actually in favour of Edward V, and that potentially Edward V was in Ireland, underwent a coronation, and was at the head of this army that arrives in England. That remains disputed. The important part for this bit of the story is really that Max involves himself in the 1487 affair. So the most recent discovery from the Missing Princes Project is this receipt for a load of pikes that are bought by Maximilian to be provided to the army that is going to invade England. We know they have access to the Landsknechts, these kind of German mercenaries, Swiss mercenaries. So Max is very happy to provide very real, tangible support to the invasion of England in 1487. You're setting aside whoever it may or may not have been about, Max is happy to put his name to this. And that continues again in the 1490s, when he's willing to back that second pretender, the man that history, again, often remembers as Perkin Warbeck, who claimed to be Richard of England, Richard Duke of York, the younger of the princes in the Tower, so the second son of Edward IV. And again, Max is very, very happy to throw considerable amounts of weight and money and political effort behind this throughout the 1490s. He's providing Richard Perkin, whatever we're going to call him, he's providing him with money, with clothing. He's treating him like he is the rightful King of England, and he's willing to proclaim him as such. 1494, Maximilian, with his son Philip, who is Archduke of Burgundy by this point, they ride together on St. Bartholomew's Day to church with Richard. And Richard is there dressed in royal cloth of gold. He's flanked by 30 halberdiers that Max has hired, wearing Yorkist murrey and blue. And this is a very, very public statement that Max considers this person to be Richard, Duke of York, and by extension, the rightful King of England, a genuine claimant to the throne that Henry VII is sitting on. And again, the Missing Princes Project have added some documents to this. So a document that details the three physical marks that the man claiming to be Richard Duke of York had, that he said would identify him to anybody who had known Richard Duke of York. And we also have this sort of life story of his journey out of England onto the continent, dictated into Middle Dutch, which suggests again that it's being propagated in Max's territories in Burgundy, and that Max is willing to allow that happen. We know the Duke of Saxony, who was operating within Max's territory in the Holy Roman Empire, is loaning money to a man who is signing himself as Richard of England, who we often remember as Perkin Warbeck. So again, I think all of this is showing that Max is very willing to put his name to the people that are challenging Henry VII's throne and expend some political capital in proclaiming them to be the rightful heirs to England.
as well as actual capital, because he's putting his money where his mouth is as well. So, and in terms of what happens to Perkin Warbeck, Richard of England, he goes over in 1497 and then goes to Scotland, and then there's that kind of battle that doesn't take place, and then he gets, well, captured and executed not long after, after having his face beaten in, just to make sure no one recognises him, perhaps.
Anyway. Absolutely, but, and I think the interesting thing from Max's point of view is that even after he's captured, even after he has signed this confession that he is Perkin Warbeck, a boy from Tournai, he's not the real Richard Duke of York, Maximilian is still writing to Henry VII, talking about him as Richard Duke of York, and asking Henry VII to show him mercy and leniency, and sort of vouching for him for his good behaviour in the future too. So Max doesn't abandon this person, Richard or Perkin, when he becomes politically less useful, or perhaps even politically embarrassing. You know, Maximilian is staking a degree of his personal honour, I guess, on continuing to back and support this person and appeal for mercy for them.
So, I mean, I think it's quite clear that you think that the two princes, the two people that led these revolts in 87 and the 1490s were the people they said they were. Wendy, do you think Max was helping them because he believed they were who they said they were, or because he disliked Henry Tudor, or because, if there's evidence for that, or because he wanted to hurt England in some other way, or that he just sort of benefited himself to help? And what do you think his
all
motivation was?
Absolutely true. He really believed he was who he said he was. There's no doubt about it.
That's Perkin. You're talking about Richard of England there.
Richard
or
of England. Sorry, yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
And do you think the same is true for Edward V, or the Edward, the 1487, do you believe?
So many records have been destroyed. I have to be honest, I am confused as to who it might have been. We don't even know that when Lovell and Lincoln, who were the people, the English behind this conspiracy, we don't even know if they took a prince with them to Ireland. Or was the boy already there, because he's apparently been interviewed by Henry VII's Herald. So we're very confused, I am very confused on that side. But when it comes to Richard of England, I'm pretty convinced.
Okay, and so Matt, just so people know, but Matt was nodding when we were talking about the confusion circulating around Edward and 1487, that revolution, or attempted revolution. On to the topic of what you think is motivating Max in helping them then. What do you think it is, Wendy?
Motivation, well, it's certainly he doesn't like Tudor. He's fallen out big time because Tudor really let him down. They actually formed a treaty, and when Tudor invaded France, I think it was in 1492, Maximilian sent troops. He sent 6,000 troops to him, which was something enormous, considering he was actually starting his own campaign in Franche-Comte. He was trying to grab back some of the Burgundian lands. And before these troops get to Boulogne, which Henry Tudor is sieging, he makes a deal with Charles. And, you know, Maximilian is absolutely furious, much the same way that the Duke Charles of Valois was upset when Edward IV made peace with Louis XI, very much the same. But this time, I think Maximilian, he hung on to that hatred. He didn't let it go, and it was personal thing.
And so you're saying he believed these guys who said they were an illegitimate claim. That's a small part of the calculation, but also personal enmity with Henry Tudor. And then the degree to which it benefited him, was there any degree that picking a fight against supporting an anti-English force supports him? Is that one for you, Matt?
I think it's tricky because Burgundy and England had traditionally had such close ties through trade. You know, a lot of the English wool goes to Burgundy. So there are really close ties and really good reasons why England and Burgundy wouldn't want to fall out. And there is also the fact that they have always tended to have a common enemy in France. But I think, you know, when you're talking about Max's motivations here, I think it's difficult, as Wendy said, it's really difficult to think that it's one thing that is driving Max. This is something, you know, it falls into his lap, and he can scratch so many itches with this at one time that it's almost too good for him to say no to. I think one of the striking things that we can point to as well is Wendy mentioned earlier that, you know, Duke Charles, previous Duke of Burgundy, had staked his Lancastrian claim to the throne of England. And Maximilian is also clearly aware of his own claim, because part of what he does with Richard Perkin is have him sign over his claim to England to Max if he dies without an heir. So this gives Max, you know, a great big shining incentive to back this person. If even if they fail, if they win, he gets an ally, he would hope, on the throne of England, although I'd imagine the French also thought the same when they sent Henry VII over. He would imagine he's going to get an ally on the throne in England, but if that doesn't happen, he can then claim all of that latent sort of Lancastrian legitimacy, but he can also pull on some Yorkist legitimacy then, because the second son of Edward IV has handed over the Yorkist claim to Maximilian too. So there are ways in which he's quietly sort of perhaps bolstering his own potential claim to the throne of England one day. And I think that's important, but it's also important that we don't overblow that, because it's a whole bunch of ifs and maybes that he's dealing in here.
Okay, but the takeaway is, yeah, we can lightly believe he really thought they were who they said they were. And the second thing is, it also served his purpose, because France is his big enemy, and therefore cultivating England on France's flank is a good bet too.
Don't think we want to be naive enough to think he's being entirely altruistic in supporting them.
Okay, what happens in the end? But basically, obviously, no spoiler alerts, both attempts to displace Henry Tudor fail. What do we make of the level of support Max gave, you know, in the eventual failure of these missions? How important was he in getting off the ground, and but also perhaps in not supporting him enough to be more successful? Do you want to go on that one?
Well, I think he could have done more, perhaps. Maybe a few more ships, a few more troops, and a bit more money. But of course, Max was always notoriously short of money his whole life, and he died in great debt. Right. So, but I think the reason that perhaps they failed, I mean, that the first one, the 87 conspiracy, really they should have won. If you think about it, the reign of Tudor was less than 2 years old. It was a pitched battle. You know, maybe it was just the fact they had better generalship at Stoke with the Earl of Oxford, but almost that one could have made it over the line. But with Richard of England, it was just a disaster. He was doomed before he ever set sail from the Netherlands. Because Tudor, you can never underestimate him. He was clever, and he set up such a spy network, and he rounded up everybody in England who was going to support him, including his own chamberlain, Sir William Stanley, who he sent to the block. And this was the guy who gave him his crown at Bosworth. So the atmosphere in England must have been terrible. I think the aristocracy, the gentry, were trembling. A toxic atmosphere at the court. But that, personally, I think that's the reason he did not succeed. Plus the fact, of course, he didn't have anything called luck. And that great, one of the greatest generals ever, Napoleon, that he relied very much, he believed in a soldier having luck. And yeah. Richard didn't have it, and Tudor had it when he landed in 85.
So, Matt, what do you think? Obviously, bad luck plays at hand.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, Maximilian backs the 1487 invasion, and as Wendy said, it's on the toss of a coin once you get into battle against each other, and it just turned out that Henry's army, led by Oxford, was possibly a bit better disciplined, a bit better armed, and a bit better armoured than the Irish contingents in particular who'd come over. But I think for Henry, that must have been a terrifying moment, because you think about, you know, a foreign invasion 2 years into your reign, and that's exactly how he'd taken the throne from Richard III. So I don't think Henry would have underestimated the threat that he was facing at Stoke, although he's afterwards very, very keen to sort of laugh it off and brush it aside as if it was nothing. With Richard and Perkin, clearly there was a flaw in his determination. He wasn't kind of cut out for this. He invades England three times, and all three times it ends in failure, and the last one ends in his capture. He seemed to almost have everything he needed at his disposal, and I think maybe, you know, Max might have done more in 1487. There's a strong suspicion that he was going to send more troops with Lambert Simnel, with the army that came over, and that they were diverted at the last minute somewhere else. So they might have tipped the balance on the battlefield, some more professional troops. But I think he does do a lot for Richard in the 1490s in terms of, as I said, staking his money, his reputation, his political capital on publicly backing him and presenting him as the real Richard Duke of York. And I think that really gives Perkin a platform, Richard a platform, to operate throughout the 1490s. You know, without Max, I think he would have struggled to get as far as he did.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Okay, so what does Max's involvement in these internal disputes in England tell us about, I suppose, the value of looking at England from the outside, from other, you know, from across the Channel at this time?
I think it's vital. You know, all of this problems in England for Henry VII, all of the confusion around what's going on, that isn't happening in a vacuum just in England. It's being heavily influenced by events in Ireland, in France, in the Holy Roman Empire, in Italy, and the need in the 1490s for the Holy League to find some kind of cohesive movement against France. All of those things are playing into the support that pretenders against Henry VII are able to get and not able to get. So if we want to understand all of this that's going on, the English story is absolutely key, but it needs to be set in its proper European context. And I think without understanding what's going on everywhere else and what's feeding everybody else's actions and what's motivating everybody else around Henry VII in other nations, we will never see the whole picture. So it's vital that we look at it through a European lens too.
It's kind of astonishing. I mean, obviously the documents that the Missing Princess Project have unearthed in the last 2 or 3 years have also shown the documentary value in looking across the water to see what you can find elsewhere. Wendy, before we wrap up, let's turn back to Max himself, the man that we started with. I mean, I think you told me once that he'd had something like 27 illegitimate children or something.
No, I think I've tracked down about 18 so far.
18. And fought 27 wars. And, you know, he dies in 1519, having been Holy Roman Emperor. And what's his legacy? What did he achieve what he wanted to achieve in his life, do you think?
Yes, but it was achieved posthumously, but he achieved it. Just before he died, he was trying to get his grandson Charles crowned King of the Romans, and it didn't happen. And when he dies and there is the election for the new Holy Roman Emperor, it is one almighty struggle. Two main contenders, Charles, obviously, and guess who? The King of France. By now we've moved on to Francis I. And it was an amazing result, because the deciding factors were not the bribes, there wasn't not the intrigue, not the intimidation that was going on. But the deciding factor was the popularity. In fact, I've even seen it written, the hero worship of Maximilian by the German peoples. And that swung it. Plus the fact they weren't very happy about having a French emperor. So at the end of the day, Charles was elected unanimously just 6 months after his death. So he's established the dynasty. And that was what his father wanted to do. That was what Frederick's aim was. But he didn't have the resources, he didn't have the character to do that. But Max, he picked up the mantle. And, you know, the Holy Roman emperors, until its dissolution in 1806, were Habsburgs, except for 2 years, I think, in the 18th century. So it was a heck of a legacy. And of course, they ruled Austro-Hungary Empire until 1918. So he really did leave a legacy. And, you know, we're still writing, we're reading, we're evaluating, we're talking about Maximilian. And that's 500 years on. So I think he'd been pretty pleased.
Brilliant. Matt, anything? You might be outside your period, the Habsburg Empire, up until 1806, but what's your sense of Max and his legacy?
Somewhere far in a distant and murky future for me, I think. it's impossible not to see him as someone who has laid the foundations for the immense success that the Habsburgs have, you know, within a generation. In the 16th century, they're ruling vast swathes of Europe, you know, including Spain and things like that, you know. It's impossible not to see Maximilian as a key foundational figure in doing all of that. And I think when I was writing my book about the Princes in the Tower, I was talking about Max because obviously he's involved in all of this. And there's a quote by Niccolo Machiavelli, you know, the author of The Prince, And he wrote of Maximilian, he said, he governs his country with great justice. He's also a good general, skillful and successful in war. And the only criticism he would offer was that if he could get over two qualities, weakness and an easy virtue, he would be a perfect man. So, you know, there's a fairly glowing praise there from someone who we like to think knows about politics and political success.
And also possibly one of the most cynical men in a thousand years.
Yeah, yeah. But he likes Max.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you very much. And well, thank you to Matt Lewis and Wendy Moorhen for joining us on the Ricardian podcast. And thank you to everyone for listening in. As I mentioned earlier, Maximilian I is the cover star of the latest edition of the Ricardian Bulletin, the members magazine of the Richard III Society. If you aren't already a member and would like to find out more, please visit our website at richardthethird.net. That's Richard followed by three I's. And .net. There's lots more information there about membership and member benefits, and you can also join there too. If you've enjoyed listening to the podcast, please do rate it, share it, and pass it on. Until next time, then, that's all from us. Thank you for listening.